Let's now turn to the celebration of the 82nd, or what would have been the 82nd birthday of Martin Luther King. I'm joined by Gerald Horn, who holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moores Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He's also written extensively about the film industry, and he's written more than 24 books, including The Color of Fascism, Lawrence Dennis, Racial Passing, and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism in the United States, The Final Victim of the Blacklist, John Howard Lawson, Dean of the Hollywood 10, and Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising and the 1960s. And thank you so much for joining us, Gerald Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
We just started out talking about what happened in Tunisia, and if you saw any of the Al Jazeera footage, the young people there, frustrated, angry, educated, not necessarily well, but educated, but no job prospects. And the whole thing was sparked by a college graduate who was selling fruit on the street corner, and the cops hassled him because he didn't have a permit, and they took away his fruit, and then he set fire to himself. So I'm trying to get a sense here of what we're seeing today on a global scale, how it has echoes of what Martin Luther King was doing before he was assassinated.
Well, I think that's a perceptive question. It's well known that the movement that Martin Luther King came to symbolize was a movement dominated by youth. This is true for a number of reasons, not least being that youth oftentimes are dissatisfied or more dissatisfied with the status quo than their elders, and oftentimes still their elders have gotten it wrong, which sometimes is right and sometimes is wrong. Martin Luther King himself was only in his mid-20s, in the mid-1950s, when he was catapulted into prominence. You may also recall the case of Emmett Till, the young black youth from Chicago who goes to Money, Mississippi in the mid-1950s and winds up returning to Chicago in a casket after being subjected to a racist lynching. This helps to serve as a catalyst to the entire civil rights movement. And as noted, he was a young person. The four little girls who were blown up in a Birmingham church in 1963 in the same neighborhood in which Condoleezza Rice and Angela Davis were born and came to prominence. This bombing also was a catalyst for the movement because the snuffing out of their lives was seen, like the snuffing out of the life of a 9-year-old girl in Tucson, Arizona, the past week, as a particularly heinous crime. The shock troops of the civil rights movement, those who were in the forefront of the sit-ins and the swim-ins and the read-ins, the segregated public libraries, was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mostly teenagers and college youth, who were oftentimes more fearless than their counterparts of age. If you look at the counterpart of SNCC, the Students for a Democratic Society, who played such a pivotal role not only in the anti-war movement but in the civil rights movement, likewise, these are younger people. Berkeley, 1964, which kicks off this entire student movement, mostly teenagers and young people. So it is accurate to draw a line from what's going on in Tunisia, which similarly involves the uprising of young people, and what happened in the United States, particularly in the Deep South, beginning in the 1950s.
And again, I'm speaking with historian Gerald Horn, author of The Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising, and the 1960s. And given the personal tragedy, if you will, of LBJ's and his presidency, and the recognition, however belated, that the war in Vietnam consumed his presidency and foreclosed the war on poverty and all of the attempts at reforms, which were, you know, haven't been seen since, frankly. And I recall, of course, that, interestingly enough, that even though that's what happened to LBJ, and I think historians and he certainly know it, Martin Luther King, when he started to make comparisons between the war on poverty at home and the war in Vietnam, taking all the treasury and you can't have guns and butter, he got castigated, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He was denounced by some of our more prestigious editorial boards at our leading newspapers. It was said that he was stepping out of line by veering into the realm of foreign policy. We should long remember and little forget his famous speech that he gave at Riverside Church in Upper Manhattan in April 1967, where he basically laid down a gauntlet, not only in the feet of the LBJ administration, but before the U.S. people themselves, basically telling them that you cannot have guns and butter, that it's very difficult for Dr. King to go to his constituency and try to tell them about the virtues of nonviolence, while, as he put it, the U.S. government was one of the greatest purveyors of violence in the world today. And I think we should also remember that there's a particular Pacifica connection, because one of the closest advisors to Dr. King was Jack O'Dell, a former chairman of the board of the Pacifica Foundation, now in retirement in Vancouver, British Columbia, reaching his 80s, perhaps his early 90s by now. And it was John F. Kennedy himself who took Dr. King into the Rose Garden of the White House, presumably to evade the prying ears and wiretaps of the FBI, to tell Dr. King that he should basically oust Jack O'Dell because of Jack's supposed left-wing credentials and connections. And Dr. King formally did so, but actually kept a sort of underground connection to Jack and continued to receive his counsel. And I think that this is a kind of history, sadly, that has been forgotten, not least as we begin to mark the 82nd birthday of Dr. King.
And General Horn, in terms of Martin Luther King and foreign policy, surely the civil rights movement did have a foreign policy component, in as much as that we were trying to capture the moral high ground in the Cold War, and the Soviets, on the other hand, would say, "Well, you know, how can you spread democracy in Africa, for example, when you limit it to your own African Americans at home?"
You put your finger on a very important point. It is precisely that dynamic, historians such as myself and other historians have argued, is the key to unlock the apparent mystery of why Jim Crow began to fall when it did. That is to say that the United States certainly had problems in pointing to itself as a paragon of human rights virtue in the Cold War battle with Moscow when it tolerated such atrocious activity and behavior towards its own citizens. And out of that dynamic, you began to see the erosion of the more excessive and egregious aspects of U.S.-style apartheid. But I think it's important to recognize, and this is going to be the subject of a soon-to-be-published book of my own, that this dynamic, this connection between the domestic and the international did not just begin in the 1950s during the Cold War. Indeed, if you look at the founding of the United States itself in the latter part of the 18th century, I think it's very curious that at the same time the United States was being founded, there was an abolitionist movement taking flight in Great Britain. And the abolitionist movement, that is to say the movement to abolish slavery, basically reached its apex in London at a time when the United States was becoming one of the greatest slave empires that the world had ever known. This led to London constantly castigating the United States for its pretensions towards democracy at the same time it was tolerating slavery. And I dare say that that dynamic played a role in terms of the erosion of support for slavery. And certainly when Abraham Lincoln issued his Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, one of the essential reasons he did so was not only because of some sort of morality concerning enslaved Africans, but also he wanted to keep abolitionist Britain on side. That is to say, there was a danger that London would tip the scales in favor of the Confederacy, the so-called Confederate States of America, that launched the Civil War for the principle and purpose of keeping Africans in bonds. And by issuing the Emancipation Proclamation, Mr. Lincoln was able to show a meaningful distinction between the blue and the gray, between Washington and Richmond, and that helped to tip the scales, basically staying the hand of London in terms of possibly intervening on the side of the Confederate States of America. So I dare say that throughout the history of this republic, there has been a close tie between the domestic and the global, not least when it comes to human rights.
Well, of course, Gerald Horn, the great tragedy of the Cold War was, since quite simply the reason we had a Cold War was we couldn't afford to have a hot war, and in effect the two superpowers, the Soviets and the United States, took out their frustrations at this stalemate through these surrogate wars, and particularly on the continent of Africa, which have led to much of the problems today. And of course now we have the largest country in Africa, Sudan, splitting in two with an extremely uncertain future with a great likelihood of civil war.
uncertain future indeed. It was oftentimes said during the Cold War that what prevented a Third World War was war in the Third World. And there is certainly something to that aphorism. At the same time, I think that it's important for we of the United States to recall that that particular dynamic also led to a process that catapulted the present occupant of the White House into the chair that he now holds. What I'm saying is that when the so-called Mau Mau revolt erupted in Kenya in the early 1950s, there was fear and apprehension in Washington about where this struggle was leading. This was taking place at a time when Moscow had diplomatic relations with neighboring Ethiopia and was beginning a campaign to try to attract African students to the then Soviet Union to study. This led directly to the airlift that led Barack Obama Sr. to travel from Kenya, winding up at the University of Hawaii, where he meets, as we know, Stanley Dunham, and the rest is history in terms of their producing a child who now occupies the White House. So there are many different aspects to the Cold War in Africa and African Americans that I think are worth exploring.
Well, just in closing, Gerald Horn, again, I'm speaking with historian Gerald Horn, author of The Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising, and the 1960s. Just back to the domestic arena, if you will, and it seems to me that you mentioned the shooting in Arizona, and we've just been talking about Martin Luther King, of course, who was assassinated, and he joins a sort of pantheon of American martyrs, some of the most talented and interesting people this country's produced, like Jack and Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King. And it was so extraordinary that the tragedy up in Arizona touched some really impressive people. This congresswoman turns out to be a really impressive woman. Her husband's an impressive man, an astronaut. Her brother-in-law is up there in space running the space station. And this young 9-year-old girl was an extraordinary young girl, as the president so eloquently described. And then you contrast that with the assassins. These tormented people like Sirhan Sirhan and this fellow in Arizona. And it seems to me that there really is a sort of a dark and a light side in this country.
Well, I'm afraid so. And since you're speaking of assassins, we should not fail to mention James Earl Ray, who was charged with the assassination of Martin Luther King, although a congressional committee raised grave doubts about whether or not he acted alone. But in any case, when we talk about assassinations, we should not fail to forget the fact that there is a long history, I'm afraid, of political murder and political assassination in this country. We should also recall that this is a society, I'm afraid, that's suffused with violence. At last count, there are probably as many guns in this country or as there are human beings, something that appalls our peers, particularly in Western Europe. But I think that what helps to distinguish the United States perhaps from some of its peers, is that the United States also has a long history of chattel slavery. And in order to get people to work for free for hundreds of years, you have to basically employ violence in a promiscuous fashion. And I think that as long as we tend to obscure or ignore such salient facts, we'll be left scratching our heads about these kinds of tragedies that unfold with all too frequent regularity in places like Tucson, Arizona.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Gerald Horn, on this what would have been the 87th birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Thank you for inviting me.
And again, I was speaking then with Gerald Horn, who holds the John J. and Rebecca Morse Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He has written more than 24 books, including The Color of Fascism, Lawrence Dennis, Racial Passing, and The Rise of Right-Wing Extremism in the United States, The Final Victims of the Blacklist, John Howard Lawson, Dean of the Hollywood 10, and Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising, and the 1960s. Let's take a brief station break and return in a moment and discuss one of the largest legacies of the military-industrial complex 50 years on from Martin Luther King.